Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. Mondays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is off this week. Coming up, black restaurant workers earn $4 an hour less than whites. Tim Wise sends a letter to white America, and black church congregations pull together to boycott a bank. But first, the Obama administration last week concluded an agreement that gives the nation's major banks immunity from prosecution for their so-called robo-signing practices. In return, some homeowners would get small payouts from a $25 billion fund. Jordan Estevao is with The New Bottom Line, a coalition of organizations that had pressed for vigorous prosecution of the banks. He says the $25 billion is just a drop in the bucket.
The good news embedded in this is that the $25 billion of principal reduction does at least acknowledge the fact that principal reduction is needed, that it's the main, the primary way to keep people in their homes, to stabilize the housing market, stabilize the economy. And the bad news is that $25 billion, although it sounds like a pretty good figure, actually does not go very far to bring real relief to most homeowners who are underwater on their mortgages and have been affected by this financial crash caused by the banks. The mortgages that are underwater to the big five banks that are subject to this investigation are underwater by about $300 billion. So that's really the amount of money that we're talking about. It's a whole other order of magnitude. And so this settlement doesn't go far enough. The Obama administration has pushed for this settlement to conclude rapidly and has now announced a new investigation, which we hope will actually go the distance, and we hope that it is not just window dressing to cover for this relatively weak settlement.
Well, from the standpoint of many who were pushing for accountability on the part of the banks and prosecutions of those who have broken the law, the Obama administration has, in fact, been defending the banks and trying to give them immunity from future prosecution.
What we do know is that when we've said no broad release of claims, that the banks should not be given immunity for anything other than robo-signing, that at least has been heard. That is a good thing. And now there's a new investigation going around securitization fraud, and time will tell whether that is going to be taken seriously and whether the administration is going to deliver a settlement in the range of, hundreds of billions of dollars this year before the election or not.
The threat was that some, at least, of the various states would follow through on their investigation and that might result in some kind of legal process. Do you have confidence that this task force could achieve the same result?
Here's part of our concern here, is that there has been a bank fraud task force set up by the Obama administration in place for the past 2 years. And they have done very little to really bring the law to the banks, very little. And certainly no high-level bank executives have been indicted at this point. And a lot of the same people that are on that fraud task force are on this new task force, the difference being that Eric Schneiderman, who is a champion of holding the banks accountable, that is the difference. But it still remains to be seen whether the rest of this committee that has been appointed by Obama will do their job and will actually bring the law to the banks.
Jordan Estevao of The New Bottom Line. A coalition of churches representing more than 15 million African Americans has announced a boycott of the BB&T Bank. Reverend Anthony Evans is president of the National Black Church Initiative, comprised of 34,000 churches. We asked Reverend Evans why single out BB&T Bank for a seven-year boycott.
BB&T Bank is what we call a regional bank. It's not a national bank. It only covers part of the country. Well, they cover a very significant part of the country where NBCI members are in the Southeast. We have heard for years complaints about their customer service, the ability not to loan money to black businesses, the ability not to loan money to black churches and homeowners. So we launched an investigation that took a couple of years, and we looked at all sorts of data that was available. Of course, this data is not broken down by race because of the law. However, we can glean from the data what has actually happened, and the amount of complaints sort of represents the fact that they are not doing anything for or to the black community in terms of community development.
And so your investigation discovered that this particular bank is worse than other banks in the Southeast?
Absolutely, because, again, it's one of the biggest regional banks, and it's even gotten bigger during the downturn of the economy. And over the years, we have been successfully able to document they have over 35,000 complaints. And many of them are African-American, but not exclusively. They are white customers as well. BB&T is a bank that has a one-picture profit mold. They want white couples, white families who's making an assets between 70 and 300,000. That is their core people that they make money from. And they virtually just tolerate, ignore, and just deal with African-Americans simply because we are predominantly in the South and there are some employment opportunities. However, when you look at their banking pattern, where they give their money, who they give their money to, it paints a completely different picture.
And so you were able to glean that they were focusing on this particular demographic as part of their business plan.
Oh, it's no question about it. I mean, white customers in the South, BB&T would do anything for. In the way, in the manner in which they treat their black customers, who, as you well know, have just as much resources, economic resources in the South than they have their white customers. But that's not their focus. And certainly black businesses is not their focus. You asked earlier why 7 years, because it really takes a minute to persuade a number of people that this bank is just no good, just up to no good. And so we are going to use a 16-point protest against them. And, you know, we're going to march in the street. We're not going to do any sit-ins or anything like that. But I can almost guarantee you by the time we get through with them, by making sure that everybody is aware of their business practices, which is racially motivated, I believe, they are going to suffer 40% of their profits over the next 7 years. It takes time to launch a program. Usually somebody said that they're going to boycott somebody and things are going to change in 1 year. It doesn't work like that. Our economy doesn't work like that.
Now, the 40% profit loss figure, is that based upon the percentage of black customers, or do you expect a bunch of other non-black customers to also withdraw their patronage of that bank?
Absolutely. In doing our research about the 35,000 complaints that they have against them, vast majority of them are white complaints, especially white businesses. Again, white businesses, white couples, that's where they're going after in the Southeast region and where they are located at all over the country. You cannot name me a major African-American charitable or nonprofit who uses BB&T as the exclusive sponsors, because BB&T is not interested in that, because that's not where they make money at. But they do make money off their white counterparts in the Southeast and where they're imprinted at all over the country. And so we calling foul, the black church is calling foul. In addition to that, they have systematically started foreclosing on black churches from 2007 to the present. There has been hundreds of black churches that they have closed foreclosed on. Even when these black congregations have tried to sit down with them to renegotiate the loan, they have not heard of it. And there's one famous case in Atlanta where even the Atlanta D.C. occupation movement came to help that black church maintain their houses of worship.
Now, is this boycott of BB&T going to be to the exclusion of pressures against other banks that may be even more powerful and economically influential?
Well, not necessarily. We hope that this will spur other boycotts against other banks and that we would have a sort of a banking revolution going on. As you well know, we have had that taking place since the downturn of the economy. And just yesterday, Attorney General Eric Holder had a settlement with all the banks concerning their dirty tricks when it came to mortgages. So it's very evident that I'm not fishing for these complaints. These complaints are there. They're on the surface. Everybody knows about them. 35,000, what we've been able to document, is only the tip of the iceberg, given the fact that the banks just made a settlement with the attorney generals from around the country.
Well, a lot of folks think that settlement basically immunizes the banks, at least regarding their robo-signing practices.
Absolutely. And as you well know, the reason why it took so long, because a number of states held out because of that reason. And it goes to show you how powerful these banks are. They were able to just pay pennies on the dollar on what they actually took from the American people. And now they are up to tune of $2,000 per homeowner. And after that, they don't have any legal exposure. I think this is outrageous. I didn't believe that it was a good agreement when I first heard about it. But now, giving the details, it turned out to be a bad agreement, and that's why we are not going along with the Hokie-Doke, and that's why we're going at the BB&T Bank.
Reverend Anthony Evans of the National Black Church Initiative in Washington. Restaurant work is hard and often poorly paid, and a new study shows that blacks are largely confined to the worst jobs in the industry. The Restaurant Opportunities Center United has filed a class action suit against the Darden restaurant chain, which includes Red Lobster, the Olive Garden, Longhorn Steakhouse, and Capital Grill. Saru Javaraman is the co-director of the center. She says whites get the better paying jobs in the front of the restaurants, while blacks are clustered in the back and make $4 less an hour.
And that's most starkly true at the Capital Grill Steakhouse, which is the fine dining steakhouse within the company and where we find the only true livable wage jobs to be in waitstaff and bartending and management positions. But very, very few workers of color in those positions in the steakhouse, and no mobility between restaurants like the Olive Garden and Red Lobster, where there are more workers of color, and the Capital Grill Steakhouse, where the livable wage jobs are to be found.
So these good jobs, the jobs in which a person can make a living wage, like the bartender, the people we see out front, we find that black folks and brown folks aren't engaged in that kind of employment. But you found that 58% of black restaurant workers are confined at the lowest wage segment of the industry.
That's right, which is quick serve or fast food. Workers of color are not even, it's not even that they're not even getting to the bartending and waitstaff positions. A lot of times they're not even getting to the restaurant. They're not getting to the fine dining restaurant where those jobs are to be found. They're stuck in quick serve, fast food jobs, not having access to, whether it's geographically, social networks-wise, discrimination-wise, the livable wage restaurants and the livable wage positions within those restaurants. What that means for workers of color, the fact that they're in quick serve, fast food, not able to get into those livable wage positions, is a $4 wage gap for workers of color. On the whole, workers of color earn $4 less than white restaurant workers. And when you're talking about poverty wages across the board, $4 less really means the difference between being below the poverty level. It's critical that we really reduce that gap.
In those restaurants, does it appear to be part of their business plan to not include people of color in their workforce, at least not in the visible workforce?
I don't know that it's openly intentional, but I will say that we conducted a study in 2009 where we sent almost 200 pairs of white and people of color applicants into fine dining restaurants, with people of color having better resumes and otherwise equivalent personalities and modes of being. And the white applicants had twice the chance of a person of color getting one of those front of the house, bartending or waitstaff positions. Whether it's a business model or what, I do think employers definitely kind of openly prefer white workers.
The restaurant industry, whose lobby group was once headed up by Herman Cain, the Republican presidential aspirant, they claim that they can only stay in business if they impose these terribly low wages. But you've done studies that show that's not true.
No, absolutely not. We've got plenty of what we call high-road employers, employers that are doing the right thing, providing livable wages and good working conditions. We've just put out a report profiling them. That shows that actually providing better wages, not only are they able to stay in business with better wages, they find that employees turn over less. There's far less employee turnover and greater productivity among their employees. And so they find in the long run, they do better. They do better than other employers because they're able to sustain their employees for longer periods of time, and employees are providing better food and service to the customer, and that only helps the bottom line.
We're constantly told, including by our president, that the United States is going to be a service economy. But if service workers, like restaurant workers, are paid such abysmally low wages, we're talking about a poverty economy.
That's right, especially because the restaurant industry right now is neck and neck with retail as the largest private sector employer in the country. There are over 10 million restaurant workers in America, and the National Restaurant Association just put out their forecast saying not only are they going to make record profits this year of $635 billion, but they also predict by the end of the year that 10 people in America will be working in restaurants. So that's their own prediction, and the saddest part about it is that while 1 in 10 people in America are working in restaurants, 7 of the 10 lowest paid jobs in America and the 2 absolute lowest paid jobs are restaurant jobs. So what does that mean? That means the largest industry in America is also the lowest paying industry. So we're, through our industry, through the restaurant industry, we're bringing all wages down.
And of course, an ever-increasing proportion of families depend upon the wages of women. But we see that the wages of restaurant employees who depend upon tips for their living, their paid wages, haven't increased in 20 years. It still stands at $2.13 an hour for a minimum wage for tipped workers.
That's right. And unfortunately, that is actually thanks to the National Restaurant Association and Herman Cain in particular. They have really lobbied to keep it at $2.13 frozen for now more than 20 years. And the saddest part about that is that the vast majority of workers who earn that wage, tipped workers, are women. Two-thirds of all tipped workers in America are women. And so what that means is that while most industries allow have some form of lower wage for women because of private employer discrimination, in our industry, having a lower wage for women is a matter of law. It's a matter of a lobbying group that has succeeded in having a lower wage for women. The National Restaurant Association is also reporting that they're making record profits this year, a jump of 4% from 2011. There's just no reason why workers have to be paid the slave wages of $2.13. It's just not acceptable.
There's a new report out called Tipped Over the Edge. Any new information in there?
Yes. We've collected more than 5,000 surveys of restaurant workers and put that together with a ton of government data analysis to show that women are the majority of the restaurant industry, they're the majority of tipped workers, that this lower tip minimum wage really is impacting women and families far more than people realize, and unfortunately that women of color are actually even more impacted than anybody else. We found that for black women in particular, black women lose almost $470,000 over a lifetime because of the gender pay equity gap in the industry, which is far exacerbated by the lower tip minimum wage. We found that if you raise the tip minimum wage to a decent amount, maybe, you know, $5 or 70% of the regular minimum wage, that would reduce the gender wage equity gap in the industry by at least one-fifth.
And what is the rationale that the industry presents for paying what is actually a token wage?
They say that they'll go out of business if they're forced to pay more. The irony about that is that there are 7 states in America, including California, Washington, some of the states that have the most successful restaurant industries, have no tip credit, meaning no difference between the regular minimum wage and the tip minimum wage. The restaurant industries in those states are doing fine. They're doing great, actually. California's industry is growing by leaps and bounds. And so the argument that the restaurant industry would suffer greatly if they had to pay more than $2.13 doesn't hold water when you look at the evidence. The other argument they make is that this allows freedom to the customers to be able to express how they felt about their service, because the vast majority of workers' income, tipped workers' income, comes from tips. Now, the problem with that is essentially the industry is saying, you customers, you're the ones who should be paying these workers' wages. You're essentially subsidizing the restaurant industry through tips. It's just not morally right, and it certainly doesn't work sustainability-wise for the workers.
And it does not recognize the workers' human right to a decent wage.
Right, or a stable wage, because tips fluctuate, as you know, particularly during economic crisis. You know, the restaurant profits were doing great, but tips did fluctuate. People tipped less when they were feeling kind of the crunch. And so workers' tips fluctuate in seasons, different nights. It's a very hard living. And it, for us, what $2.13 has meant is that we have members around the country who are homeless. We have members in New Orleans and Detroit who go in and out of homelessness because they can't afford to pay the rent. There's no stable income earning $2.13 plus tips.
Saru Javaraman of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United in Washington. President Obama reached a compromise with Catholic church leaders who objected to making contraceptives available to workers in their health care facilities. We spoke with James Thindwa, a veteran labor activist in Chicago. He says the whole controversy would be moot if the U.S. had a real universal health care system.
What the media pundits and, you know, all these talking heads are missing is that this really is a symptom of a very dysfunctional healthcare system. And it's also really an opportunity for those of us who have been championing single payer to start really pointing to this phony debate, things like this phony debate, as a symptom of the lack of a national healthcare plan. In societies where there's national healthcare, including Italy, which is heavily Catholic, they're not having this debate. Because once you institute a national health care plan, you eliminate these exemptions that churches want in institutions because, you know, basically the government is paying for health care. I mean, imagine, look at what happens right now. Members of Congress who are female are fully covered. The same Catholics who are complaining about Obama health care imposing a kind of government mandate to them to cover health care don't mind paying taxes. Nobody has ever complained that their tax money provides members of Congress with full coverage of health care, including contraception. The same women in Congress, the right-wing Republican women who are now on national TV attacking this mandate, are essentially enjoying full health care benefits paid for by the very same people, the same Catholic churches, the bishops. Yes, all of us are paying taxes, and nobody has asked for an exemption. It's not just contraception. It's a sign that the right wing in this country is enjoying a kind of special status, that the issues that they care about somehow need to be treated differently. They're asking for this kind of exceptionalism, this exemption. You and I don't get to say, hey, we oppose the Iraq war, we oppose the Afghanistan war, we don't want parts of our taxes that pay for war, we want to be exempted from paying for them. Nobody opts out. So what kind of a society, what kind of a system, what kind of government are you going to have when everybody can opt out based on personal, religious, you know, moral objection? But somehow the right wing has been granted this ability to withdraw support, to withdraw payment if they morally object to something. You know, we had this debate in Illinois with pharmacists who said they didn't want to prescribe the morning after pill. They were objecting on religious grounds. It's like, you know, well, you know, if you can't even write a prescription for the morning after pill, maybe you shouldn't be a pharmacist because people are coming to the pharmacy to get health care. And if you object, don't be a pharmacist. But I think this is just part of a problem in which Democrats really have failed to weigh in and make it clear that these are basic fundamental civil rights and we don't get to opt out of them.
So that if we had a universal, real universal healthcare system, as other industrialized countries do, this argument about contraception would be moot.
Would be a moot point. Michelle Bachmann, presumably, she's covered. If she's using contraception, we're paying for it. But she's out there attacking contraception coverage for people who work in Catholic churches. So my point is that, you know, when the government is insuring people and the government is in charge of insuring, it eliminates this problem. There's no debate. States are covering their citizens, you know, local government, state government, national governments. Those with government health insurance are enjoying coverage that we all pay for. We don't get to opt out, regardless of the fact that, you know, it includes contraception.
Many social observers of the United States have noted that what sets the U.S. apart from Canada, from Western Europe, from most countries in the world that have a social compact is race.
This is a little appreciated explanation for why the United States can't achieve universal health care. We sort of tap dance around it, and I think there are a lot of other valid reasons why that's the case, one of which is very powerful insurance companies, very powerful drug companies, very powerful U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who always weigh in and spend a lot of money to prevent expansion of health care coverage in the United States into a sort of a national health care plan. But a little appreciated explanation is race. If you look back at the countries, if you examine the countries that actually cover everybody, that have national health insurance programs, 1950s, when they achieved those programs, they were relatively homogeneous. Japan, you know, Germany, Great Britain, Europe, you know, even Canada. But in recent decades, those countries have become more and more diverse. And in fact, statistics are showing that today in many of those countries, I think they would maintain the healthcare, the sort of the social contract around healthcare, but the numbers have changed. There's now more opposition. And I think that, that comes from the sense it's white people saying they don't want the tax dollars subsidizing the healthcare of immigrants from Africa and, you know, black folks who are now becoming part of this population. So that consensus is now a bit frayed, although it's still very strong.
So we see other parts of the world actually devolving and becoming more like a backward United States.
Part of it is sort of the pressures that the global economic crisis has brought on. So it's very easy to scapegoat immigrants. When politicians are running out there saying there's no money, we're broke, it's very difficult to get up there and start talking about expansive universal programs, including healthcare. Look, Americans really, sometimes they point to their diversity and multiculturalism as a plus. I think we see that all the time. And, you know, I think when American leaders are on the international stage, they like to talk about this is a sign of a healthy and culturally, politically robust society. But diversity has also been in the country's Achilles heel in the sense that, you know, strong currents of racism remain in this society. And that militates against the, you know, sort of a national consensus that we need on such questions as national healthcare. Gary Young, who writes with The Nation, he went to Arizona and was interviewing Tea Party activists in cafeterias and so forth. There was one woman who was particularly striking, and this woman has no healthcare herself. Her number one issue is immigration, illegal immigration. She spends night and day walking around with a sign, writing letters to politicians, marching. She is so obsessed with shutting down the border and keeping immigrants out. Gary Young asked her, wouldn't it be better if all these immigrants, if you guys worked with them and created a kind of political power so you can fight for health care benefits for everyone? Wouldn't you come off better off? You know, you don't have health care right now. You don't seem to be upset about it. And she says, well, you know, that's less important. For this woman, it was more important to stop illegal immigration than actually to have health care for herself. That's how powerful this current is in this country. It's also, Glenn, it's important to acknowledge that historically there have been ways that this has been overcome. I mean, the coalitions have been created in this country. I mean, if you go back to Roosevelt, Social Security started out excluding black folks. Once people taste the benefits and the value of those benefits, that tends to tramp racism. Right now you have one of the biggest, strongest coalitions of senior citizens, you know, rich and poor, black and white, Latino, who actually have created a formidable coalition that has been very, very effective at preventing the privatization of Social Security. Social Security survives today because of a diverse coalition that works to defend it together.
So the formula is not to tiptoe around race, but to press on and create universal programs.
Look, as we've globalized the economies of the world, we're also globalizing disease. That means that increasingly we're going to be, the United States is going to be subject to, epidemics, diseases that might come from other countries, right? You know, swine flu and so forth. And so you have immigrants taking care of families here. You have immigrants working as nannies. They're working as bus drivers. They're working in restaurants. When you have an outbreak of an epidemic, let's say tuberculosis, do you want a country where people are so afraid to go to the doctor, they can't go to the emergency room because they don't have immigration papers? What are the implications for containing epidemics if you have that kind of atmosphere of fear? So for this woman, you know, that needs to be articulated, that it's not in her interest, it's not in anybody's interest to have millions of immigrants, right, you know, walking around out there with no access to health care, because it's when these epidemics occur. You know, with global warming, a lot of tropical diseases now are going to be essentially migrating across the seas into the United States. So we're really globalizing more than just economies. We're globalizing disease. It's a real question that I think politicians need to start talking about and explaining why national health care is critical. You don't want your babysitter who has TB to be afraid to go to the doctor or to not be able to afford going to the hospital. So you sort of rationalize everything when you have a national health plan. I think the right wing understands the power of these sort of multiracial coalitions. I think if you look back to 2005 when George Bush tried to privatize Social Security, how the NAACP, labor unions, AARP fought together, pushed back. You had a really strong multiracial, young and old people who fought together to protect Social Security. So that's why in this campaign there's been some not so veiled attempts to invoke race. You have Newt Gingrich saying, you know, food stamp president, and they're also trying to pit the young against the old. They understand that if they're going to privatize Social Security, the only way that they can succeed is to sort of turn the program into a welfare program. That's why they're talking about means testing, for example, right? Having rich people being denied Social Security benefits or Medicare benefits because they make too much money. But look, it's an insurance program. If you paid into it, it shouldn't matter whether you're rich or not. You paid into an insurance program, and you're entitled to it. But behind that effort, behind this talk of means testing, is to try to break that coalition. Because once rich people stop getting benefits from Social Security or Medicare, then they stop participating in defending those programs. And you reduce it to a welfare program because the people who stay on it essentially are there because they don't have means. They're poor people. And then they become easy to attack. It's the fastest way, the surest way to end Social Security and Medicare is to start means testing. So you're hearing Republicans talk about it. It's a way to undercut that multiracialism, that sort of strong coalition that has kept these programs and protected them from privatization.
Labor activist and writer James Thinjwa in Chicago. Anti-racism activist and lecturer Tim Wise knows full well that race has always held back social development in the United States. Wise has a new book titled Dear White America, A Letter to a New Minority. The census projects that non-whites will make up a majority of the U.S. population by the year 2042. We asked Tim Wise if most whites have come to grips with their looming minority status.
I think it has dawned on some. I think there's several things going on that I point out in the book, and the demographic shift is certainly one of them. But that takes place against a backdrop where there are several other things going on, all of which I think are challenging a lot of white folks' sense of normalcy, a lot of white folks' sense of what it is to be an American, this designation that we who are white have always been able to claim for ourselves as sort of the floor model, the prototype of that term. The other trends that I identify are, of course, the election of a man of color as president, who, despite the fact that he rarely, if ever, speaks about issues of race, obviously, and certainly does not pursue a racial justice agenda, nonetheless, to white folks, just the very presence of someone like Barack Obama, who has a name that, of course, to many white folks is exotic, and a father who wasn't even, you know, African American, but straight African, you know, that to a lot of white folks upsets their sense of what leadership is supposed to look like. Then there's the shifting in the economy. You know, for the first time in 75 years, you have white folks looking down the barrel of double-digit unemployment. That has not been new for black folks in this recession, or Latino folk, or indigenous people, Southeast Asian folks. But for white folks, to have double-digit unemployment as a possibility is horrifyingly unique. And so all of a sudden, that upsets white folks' sense of economic normalcy, this idea that if you just work hard and play by the rules, everything will work out okay. People of color know that that's always been nonsense. But white folks have had the luxury of believing it, and now we're being challenged with that assumption. And then finally, is the popular culture. We live in a society where 25 years ago, roughly, MTV would not even play videos by black artists other than Michael Jackson. And now we live in a popular culture where it's really quite multicultural. I mean, it's thoroughly so. You have hip-hop artists that make records with country artists. You have, you know, all of a sudden young white kids have posters on their walls of icons and superstars that their parents probably can't identify with at all. And so when you combine that, which is a challenge to white cultural hegemony, with the challenge to white economic stability and the challenge to the notion of what a leader looks like and the demographic shift, all of that is creating for a large segment of white America, and certainly the Tea Party contingent of it, this sort of perfect storm for white anxiety. And that's what I think we're facing in the next 10 to 15 years.
You've called big government and other assorted Tea Party watchwords a racial code word, but isn't austerity then also a racial code word?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the way that the last 40 years of American politics have played out, any time that you have politicians in either party, I should point out, either major party, calling for austerity, calling for downsizing government, calling for laying off government workers, calling for cutting programs to help the have-nots or the have-lessers, or at least, if not cutting them, certainly not increasing them, and not having new ones like real health care reform. You know that in the last 40 years, that is about race. Maybe 80 years ago, ago, conversations about the size of government weren't about race, because we all knew that black and brown folks were going to be excluded from those programs, like New Deal programs, from which most people of color were excluded. But in the last 40 years, as people of color gained access because of hard-fought victories in various movements and struggles, gained access to some of those same programs that white folks had always had access to, gained access to some of the jobs that white folks had always had access to, gained access to some of the communities that white folks had always had access to, then all of a sudden, there's a large segment of white America that discovered their inner libertarian and decided, oh no, you know, government intervention is bad and we need to cut these things, even though their grandparents absolutely loved big government because it saved them during the Depression and really all throughout American history. Government intervention for white folks has been the key to our success.
If austerity is a racial code word, then isn't it also a racial code word when it comes out of Obama's mouth?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it may be meant for different reasons. He may have a different set of intentionalities around the use of it. But at the very least, I would say that the use of that kind of language by the president or by the Democratic Party more broadly or by ostensible progressive or liberal forces amounts to, in effect, the recodification of racial assumptions, biases, and stereotypes. So whether or not the intent, this is what all of us who fight racism have said for years, regardless of the intent behind the use of a word like austerity, regardless of the intent of the sort of use of terminology like post-racial, regardless of the intent of saying we're going to cut government and make it leaner and more efficient, you know, people may say that thinking, well, that's just politics. And President Obama may say, well, you know, that's just politics. That's how I get these folks to vote for me. But regardless of his intent, the effect of it is to reinforce these racialized notions, these class-based and biased notions. And we really need to look at the effect, regardless of the intentionality. It's like last night I was speaking at the University of Maryland, and I was talking to students there, and I was saying, you know, no one in this country, white folks don't want to talk about race, but the president also doesn't want to talk about race. The fact that his motivation for not talking about it may not be quite as evil and pernicious as some of the folks on the right doesn't change the fact that the consequences of his silence and the consequences of liberal silence more broadly are no different than the consequences of silence brought about by antipathy or indifference. The effects, the consequences of the terminology, the consequences of the ignoring of this issue are the same, regardless of what is in someone's head as they ignore it.
You've written previously about, and you've spoken a great deal about, how the ascension of a black person to the White House might in some ways accentuate and aggravate white assumptions, for example, assumptions that whites are discriminated against more than blacks are, that might aggravate those already existing assumptions.
Right. Well, and as I note in the new book, you know, there is this study that was done just a year or so ago, which actually does find, for the first time that I'm aware of, that white folks are more likely now to believe that we are the victims of discrimination than we are to believe that folks of color are. In the past, obviously, lots of whites have said that, but it's never been the majority until after the election of a man of color as president. Now, I don't mean to suggest by that that's the president's fault. I certainly don't mean to suggest that as a result of that, you know, we should never want a president of color because it's going to make the white folks go crazy. What I am saying is that we have to be cognizant of the fact that when we put the focus on the election of black and brown faces to high places, as opposed to the larger, you know, movement-based work in the communities for justice for all people, including all people of color, we have to understand the unintended consequences of focusing on individual accomplishment of black and brown faces in high places and what that means in a society where white supremacy is still so rampant. Unless we're doing the work to undermine white supremacy every day, what otherwise might theoretically be the beneficial outcome of having a person of color in a high place gets totally undermined, even if that person of color in a high place had every intention of fighting for justice, which, of course, I'm not suggesting this president has those intentions on most days, you know, but even if he did, the ability of such a president to really bring about social, economic, and political justice for, you know, hundreds of millions of Americans would be undermined by white backlash unless we attend to that white backlash.
You flipped the script on a whole bunch of white racist pundits when you urged that whites take personal and collective responsibility in creating a better and more equal country.
Well, the thing that drives me really, I think, most crazy in this culture is this tendency for folks on the right, but really white folks generally, including a lot of people who are not really on the right, to use this term personal responsibility as a weapon against the have-nots and the have-lessers, regardless of color, but especially against people of color generally, right, to say, well, they need to stop complaining about racism, about poverty, about bad schools or whatever, and just fix those things themselves and pull themselves up and all that. It's one thing to believe in personal responsibility. I'm a father. I have two small children, and of course I teach them about being personally responsible and accountable for their actions. But the difference between the way I try to do that as a father and the way that the society tries to do it is that when I talk to my girls about taking personal responsibility for their lives, I make sure to make the point, and they're very young, but we still talk about the fact that as girls, you know, they are going to experience discrimination because there will be boys and men who will think that they are lesser. So part of being personally responsible for yourself is not just working hard, not just staying in school, not just doing all the stuff the culture says to do, but also fighting injustice. That's not what the society means when they say personal responsibility. They basically mean shut up and do what we tell you to do. And what I'm saying is if we're going to preach to those on the bottom of the power structure that they have to be personally responsible, then we at the top of the power structure, whether it's the class structure, the race structure, the gender structure, whatever, have to also apply that to ourselves. To point at somebody else while you say take personal responsibility is a negation. It's self-contradictory. I should be pointing the finger at me if I'm serious about that. And the fact that most white folks who use that phrase, and people of color who do it too, Bill Cosby several years ago, the president himself, you know, when he lectures black men and pretty much only black men on Father's Day about being better fathers, is essentially reinforcing those notions that personal responsibility only applies to the folks on the bottom of the power structure, when really, if it's going to be used at all as a concept, it has to apply to everyone.
And a theme running through this book is about how people, meaning white people, can be set up by their own myths, which sounds a lot like white folks cutting off their own noses despite black faces.
Well, yes, and it's a long-standing story. It's really the history of white supremacy. You know, it's been the history of white folks ignoring their real interest, economic, social, and cultural interest, for the sake of what W.E.B. Du Bois called the psychological wage of whiteness, the ability to feel better than someone else, even when you're getting the shaft as well. And we're seeing it today. I mean, the irony of this current economic moment is that you have a lot of white folks who really, because of privilege, because of whiteness, had the ability all of these years to really buy into the American myth, the idea that all they had to do was work hard and play by the rules and everything would work out. Now, every child of color in this country by the age of 11 knows that that's not true, knows that it's far more complicated than that. But white folks, particularly white men, have had the ability to really believe that. And now as the system is crumbling, not because of the actions of people of color or those at the bottom, but because principally of the actions of economic and political elites, they really don't know how to cope with the setback. The impact of the downturn is, of course, doubly and triply felt in communities of color. It's always folks of color who get battered the worst in these things. But interestingly, people of color, even as they are being battered, there are surveys that say that folks of color still are more optimistic about the future than white folks are, which is fascinating because what it says is that people of color over the years, and it makes sense, have built up coping mechanisms to deal with the day-to-day realities of oppression. That's how they've survived. The thing about privilege is you don't build up those skills. You don't have the preparation. You don't have the skin, which allows you to survive in spite of downturn. And I think that is what's happening. White folks have been set up to believe in a world that doesn't exist. And the danger is that when you come to realize the world as it really is, you have two choices. One is positive. It's the road of solidarity. It's the road that says, maybe I should have been working with and listening to those black and brown folk the whole time, and we wouldn't be in this mess. But the other possibility, and it's a totally open question as to which way we're going to go, is to retrench or, you know, retreat back into the logger, to use the South African apartheid era phraseology, and really try to continue to cut the best deal for yourself, you know, by projecting your own economic insecurity onto other people, blaming immigrants, blaming affirmative action, blaming high taxes, et cetera. And of course, that's the battle that we're going to see coming to a head in the next 10 to 15 years.
Tim Wise, author of the new book, Dear White America. Back in 2005, U.S. Marines slaughtered 24 unarmed armed Iraqi civilians in the small town of Haditha. The dead included 6 children between the ages of 1 and 14 and a 76-year-old amputee. But not one of the Marines charged in the Haditha massacre has gotten jail time. The last defendant, a staff sergeant who was a leader of the bloodbath, was sentenced only to reduction in rank last month. Marjorie Cohn, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, has written extensively on the Haditha massacre. We asked Cohn if there is some central lesson lying beneath all that blood.
The lesson is that the United States government should refrain from invading other countries in illegal imperialistic wars, which then lead to the torture of prisoners and war crimes. And Haditha, the Haditha massacre, was a war crime. It was a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, and under the U.S. War Crimes Act, it is punishable as a war crime. So, yes, it means an entire revamping of U.S. foreign policy to prevent and refrain from these military interventions in other countries where we have no right, legal or otherwise.
But in fact, the United States insists, while insisting that its troops be allowed to be stationed in other people's countries, it insists on those troops enjoying immunity from those countries' laws.
That's right. And that was the deal breaker which led to the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq by the end of last year, which Obama was very proud of, although he tried mightily to broker a deal with the Iraqi government to allow our troops to stay there, but the Iraqi government refused to grant immunity to U.S. troops for war crimes and other crimes. They know about things like the Haditha massacre. They know about war crimes that U.S. forces committed in other Iraqi cities, including Qaim, Abu Ghraib, Tal Ajal, Mukarradib, Mahmoudia, Hamdaniya, Samarra, Salahuddin, etc. They know that, and that's why they refuse to give immunity to U.S. troops. Also, I met the Iraqi ambassador to Austria when I was in Vienna a couple of months ago, and he said that if they give immunity to U.S. forces, they would have to give immunity to other countries as well, and they were not prepared to do that.
Now, of course, the Iraqis know about the massacres that occurred on their own soil to their own people. Why don't Americans know about the massacres that Americans carry out against other people?
Well, the corporate media keeps the news sanitized. You might see a small article, perhaps in the New York Times, about what happened in Haditha and what the result of this prosecution was, but it's not going to be featured the way it's featured in the Iraqi press, in the alternative media, such as shows like yours or articles that I write in this country. But the Iraqis are very, very aware of what happened at Haditha, and they are not happy. Many people who have spoken to the media are not happy with the result of the one trial. Now, remember, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, they were never put on trial for the Haditha massacre, even though under the well-established doctrine of command responsibility, commanders all the way up the chain of command to the commander-in-chief can be liable for war crimes if they knew or should have known that their subordinates would be carrying them out and they did nothing to stop or prevent it. And the rules of engagement were basically very much like during Vietnam, free fire zones, shoot at anything that moves. And the leadership, of course, was wanting. The staff sergeant, Frank Wooderich, who went court-martial but then struck a plea bargain. He was not charged with war crimes or murder. He was charged with 9 counts of manslaughter. He pled guilty to 1 count of dereliction of duty, and he received no jail time but a reduction in rank. 6 other Marines who participated in the Haditha massacre had their charges dismissed, and another was acquitted for his part in the massacre. But none of the leaders who were really responsible, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, etc., were brought to trial. And this is very much like the torture that has taken place, not just in Abu Ghraib in Iraq, but all over Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Guantanamo Bay, and in the secret CIA black sites. And there are estimates that thousands of men have been tortured by U.S. forces. And yet, Obama has prevented any kind of real accountability on the part of the officials and the legal mercenaries, the lawyers like John Yoo and Jay Bybee from the Bush administration, for their part in setting up this torture regime and knowing that interrogators would take action based upon it, you know, rewriting our laws, which they have no right to do, including our laws on torture. Torture is never allowed. Even in times of war, it is never allowed under our law. And so the only two incidents that have been investigated by Eric Holder, the Attorney General, are two egregious cases where people died from the torture, and there are estimates that many, many more people died from torture. In fact, 100 people at least have died in U.S. custody, many of them from torture. So you don't see real accountability here, either by the people on the ground or by the higher-ups who actually gave the orders. And then when people talk about keeping us safe, when people who would do us harm, who don't like us in the first place, see us invading other countries, illegally occupying other countries, committing war crimes like the Haditha massacre, carrying out torture, it makes them hate us even more. It makes us even more vulnerable to terrorism. And that's not even talking about the cost, the $1 trillion that these wars are costing, which certainly could be used to pick our economy up out of the toilet in this country and talk about universal health care and education and jobs. So all the way around, this war was a disaster and has done nothing but remove Saddam Hussein and from power. Yes, he was a vicious tyrant, and so is the king of Saudi Arabia. He's one of our closest allies, and so is the government of Bahrain, where the U.S. has its fifth fleet stationed. So there's a real double standard when the United States decides which countries to invade.
The routine nature of these kinds of atrocities, their repetitive nature, it becomes clear that the troops on the ground know that these activities occur, even if they don't personally take part in them. But 1 million men and women have been through Iraq. What does it mean for the health of the United States culture?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Glenn, because our troops come back, and everybody supports the troops, and we talk about the troops, and yet they come back, most of them with post-traumatic stress disorder and or traumatic brain injury. The suicide level among returning veterans is just astronomical, and yet they're hailed as heroes until they get back, and then they're just dropped like hot potatoes. I think that very instructive is Lance Corporal Roel Ryan Briones, who was the best friend of the guy T.J. Terrazas, who was killed just before the Haditha massacre, and evidently the Haditha massacre was in retaliation for the killing of this Marine Terrazas with a roadside bomb. Briones, his best friend, didn't participate in the massacre. He came in afterwards. He was 20 years old at the time. He talked about what it was like to see his buddy with a giant hole in his chin, eyes rolled back up in his skull. And then, after the massacre, Briones was ordered to take photographs of the victims of the massacre and to carry their bodies out of their homes, and he's haunted by what he had to do. He picked up a young girl who was shot in the head, and he said, and this is his words, "I held her out like this," he said, extending his arms, "but her head was bobbing up and down, and the insides fell on my legs." And then he said, "I used to be one of those Marines who said that post-traumatic stress is a bunch of bull," but he said, "all this stuff that keeps going through my head is eating me up. I need immediate help." And he's gotten into serious trouble since he returned home. So, and even the drones, even the pilots of these unmanned drones, which are illegally dropping bombs, killing civilians in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, Obama has taken that to a new level, even gone way beyond what Bush did with these drones. And the reason they use these drones is so that the pilots don't get killed and they can actually control the drones with a joystick from Nevada. But My understanding is that even some of the people, the technicians who are controlling these drones from Nevada, are suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's not just the immediate victims, the intended victims of these militaristic policies of ours. It's also our own men and women, our own troops who come back so badly scarred, psychologically, physically. They'll never be the same again. And many of them commit suicide. There's a book that I co-authored called Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. And one of the chapters in that book talks about the Winter Soldier investigation in 1971 during the Vietnam War, where many U.S. soldiers testified about war crimes they had committed during Vietnam. And then in 2008, there was a modern-day Winter Soldier hearing in Maryland where some 200 former soldiers, sailors, Marines testified about war crimes they had committed. And it's really, really moving to read these accounts and hear how they feel about what they did and what they saw. It's damaging to us and to our society, to say nothing of the people in Iraq and Afghanistan and other countries who are dead, who are wounded, whose lives have been shattered.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Giselle Hernandez.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.